There were too many slaves for the ship to hold easily, so another dozen men were chained up on the deck in the open, beneath the places where the crew would sling their hammocks. Wetutu was put in with the children, not with the women, and she was not chained, merely locked in. Agasu, her brother, was forced in with the men in chains packed like herrings. It stank under that deck, although the crew had scrubbed it down since their last cargo. It was a stink that had entered the wood, the smell of fear and bile and diarrhea and death, of fever and madness and hate. Wetutu sat in the hot hold with the other children. She could feel the children on each side of her sweating. A wave tumbled a small boy into her, hard, and he apologized in a tongue that Wetutu did not recognize. She tried to smile at him in the semi-darkness. The ship set sail. Now it rode heavy in the water. Wetutu wondered about the place the white men came from, although none of them were truly white. Sea-burned and sunburned they were, and their skins were dark. Were they so short of food that they had to send all the way to her land for people to eat? Or was it that she was to be a delicacy, a rare treat for a people who had eaten so many things that only black-skinned flesh in their cook-pots made their mouths water? On the second day out of port, the ship hit a squall. Not a bad one. But the ship's decks lurched and tumbled, and the smell of vomit joined the mixed smells of urine and liquid feces and fear sweat. Rain poured down on them in bucket loads from the air gratings set in the ceiling of the slave deck. A week into the voyage, and well out of sight of land, the slaves were allowed out of irons. They were warned that any disobedience, any trouble, and they would be punished more than they had ever imagined. In the morning, the captives were fed beans and ship's biscuits, and a mouthful each of vinegared lime juice, harsh enough that their faces would twist, and they would cough and splutter, and some of them would moan and wail as the lime juice was spooned out. They could not spit it out, though. If they were caught spitting or dribbling it out, they were lashed or beaten. The night brought them salted beef. It tasted unpleasant, and there was a rainbow sheen to the grey surface of the meat. That was at the start of the voyage. As the voyage continued, the meat grew worse. When they could, Wetutu and Agasu would huddle together, talking of their mother and their home and their playfellows. Sometimes Wetutu would tell Agasu the stories their mother had told them, like those of Alegba, the trickiest of the gods, who was great Mawu's eyes and ears in the world, who took messages to Mawu and brought back Mawu's replies. In the evening, to while away the monotony of the voyage, the sailors would make the slaves sing for them and dance the dances of their native lands. Wetutu was lucky that she had been put in with the children. The children were packed in tightly and ignored. The women were not always so fortunate. On some slave ships, the female slaves were raped repeatedly and continually by the crew, simply as an unspoken perquisite of the voyage. This was not one of those ships, which is not to say that there were no rapes. 100 men, women, and children died on that voyage and were dropped over the side. And some of the captives who were dropped over the side had not yet died, but the green chill of the ocean cooled their final fever, and they went down flailing, choking, lost. Wetutu and Agasu were traveling on a Dutch ship, but they did not know this, and it might as easily have been British, or Portuguese, or Spanish, or French. The black crewmen on the ship, their skins even darker than Watutu's, told the captives where to go, what to do, when to dance. One morning, Wetutu caught one of the black guards staring at her. When she was eating, the man came over to her and stared down at her without saying anything.
"Why do you do this? Why do you serve the white devils?"
He grinned at her as if her question was the funniest thing he ever had heard. Then he leaned over, so his lips were almost brushing her ears, so his hot breath on her ear made her suddenly feel sick.
If you were older, I would make you scream with happiness from my penis. Perhaps I will do it tonight. I have seen how well you dance.
She looked at him with her nut-brown eyes, and she said, unflinching, smiling even,
If you put it in me down there, I will bite it off with my teeth down there. I am a witch girl, and I have very sharp teeth down there.
She took pleasure in watching his expression change. He said nothing and walked away. The words had come out of her mouth, but they had not been her words. She had not thought them or made them. No, she realized, those were the words of Elegba the trickster. Mawu had made the world, and then, thanks to Elegba's trickery, had lost interest in it. It was Elegba, of the clever ways and the iron-hard erection, who had spoken through her, who had ridden her for a moment. And that night before she slept, she gave thanks to Elegba. Several of the captives refused to eat. They were whipped until they put food into their mouths and swallowed, although the whipping was severe enough that two men died of it. Still, no one else on the ship tried to starve themselves to freedom. A man and a woman tried to kill themselves by leaping over the side. The woman succeeded. The man was rescued, and he was tied to the mast and lashed for the better part of a day until his back ran with blood, and he was left there as the day became night. He was given no food to eat, and nothing to drink but his own piss. By the third day he was raving, and his head had swollen and grown soft, like an old melon. When he stopped raving, they threw him over the side. Also, for 5 days following the escape attempt, the captives were returned to their manacles and chains. It was a long journey, and a bad one for the captives. And it was not pleasant for the crew, although they had learned to harden their hearts to the business and pretended to themselves that they were no more than farmers, taking their livestock to the market. They made harbor on a pleasant, balmy day in Bridgetown, Barbados, and the captives were carried from the ship to the shore in low boats sent out from the dock and taken to the market square, where they were, by dint of a certain amount of shouting and blows from cudgels, arranged into lines. A whistle blew, and the market square filled with men, poking, prodding, red-faced men, shouting, inspecting, calling, appraising, grumbling. Watutu and Agasu were separated then. It happened so fast. A big man forced open Agasu's mouth, looked at his teeth, felt his arm muscles, nodded, and two other men hauled Agasu away. He did not fight them. He looked at Watutu and called, Be brave! To her. She nodded, and then her vision smeared and blurred with tears, and she wailed. Together, they were twins, magical, powerful. Apart, they were two children in pain. She never saw him again but once, and never in life. This is what happened to Agasu. First, they took him to a seasoning farm, where they whipped him daily for the things he did and didn't do. They taught him a smattering of English, and they gave him the name of Inky Jack for the darkness of his skin. When he ran away, they hunted him down with dogs and brought him back and cut off a toe with a chisel to teach him a lesson he would not forget. He would have starved himself to death, but when he refused to eat, his front teeth were broken, and thin gruel was forced into his mouth, until he had no choice but to swallow or to choke. Even in those times, they preferred slaves born into captivity to those brought over from Africa. The freeborn slaves tried to run, or they tried to die. And either way, there went the profits. When Inky Jack was 16... he was sold with several other slaves to a sugar plantation on Saint-Domingue. They called him Hyacinthe, the big, broken-toothed slave. He met an old woman from his own village on that plantation. She had been a house slave before her fingers became too gnarled and arthritic, who told him that the whites intentionally split up captives from the same towns and villages and regions to avoid insurrection and revolts. They did not like it when slaves spoke to each other in their own languages.